The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to equity analyst and stock markets commentator Paul Scott to discuss all things small caps. So big welcome, Paul, from sunny Malta, I understand, this week.
Yes, hello, Paul. Hello, everyone. Nice to be back.
Yeah, well, it's been a nice, relatively quiet past 7 days, a sort of minor disruption over the weekend when we had another big agentic AI report landing, this time from Certini Research, that seemed to disturb a lot of software and tech companies' share prices on Monday. But it hasn't actually displaced or disturbed the ongoing M&A theme. And we've got Harry, he's asking about the latest takeover, which came out this morning, which was fintech investor Augmentum got an offer at 111p in cash. And his question is basically, do you think the deal's going to go through? And if you'd owned any shares, what would you do? Because there has been a bit of wobbling on the M&A deals of late.
Yes, I covered that point in my podcast last night, actually. I think people need to look very carefully at every pending bid situation in their portfolios because they're starting to fall over, some of them. Obviously, the Pinewood deal was pulled and we had another one, Essensys, one of yours, where the 20p mooted bid actually turned into a 17p mooted bid. So I think there's a time to be particularly careful about pending bid situations and maybe just bank the money in the market if it's close to the bid price, because the bid could fall through. So that's the sort of precursor general point on that one. Augmentum, yeah, it's not one I've looked at in a great deal of detail, but it's an investment firm that was trading at a really, really deep discount to NAV. The bid today is something like, I think, if this is all from memory, a 27% premium to last night's close. So that sounds good enough, but still a very considerable discount to its last reported NAV. But of course, people don't necessarily believe the NAV because I think the investments are unquoted investments. So you always work on the basis the NAV will probably be a bit inflated. But I think they've only got sort of commitments from, was it 7 or 9% of the shareholder base? It was basically...
You're right. I mean, they had less than 2% irrevocables, and I think they had another 7%, which was a sort of like a comfort letter.
An indication. Yeah. So I'm what I put in my report this morning on this one. I only glanced at it briefly, but I said, is that going to be enough to get the deal through? Because I think it's being done through a scheme of arrangement, which I believe needs 75% support, don't they? So in the current markets, I think people should probably take the money, don't you? I mean, over to you, Paul. What's your opinion?
Well, I get the logic, but on this particular occasion, I think the net asset per share is roughly about 160. Now, obviously, they invest in sort of private companies. And I think their biggest three investment or investee businesses are Tide, which is a sort of like a bank for small, medium-sized companies. And it's also got a Walker, I think, is another one. And I think the other one is Sopla Bank, I think it is. So it's very difficult to get a transparent valuation and sort of like of what it is. But we are looking at, if those NAVs are anywhere near right, we are looking at a 30% discount. If I was actually owning them, I would actually hold on, because I would not be surprised if they have to actually bump up their deal. The board have agreed it. So I don't think it's going to go away. And I actually think the bidder has got a very, very nice price here. And it might well be that somebody like, say, Saba Capital comes on board, or somebody basically decides, I'll put another 10% on top because there's plenty of upside. But I'd be reticent to sell in the market, because I don't think it's going to fall through, because it could just get rejected, and then obviously, by the shareholders, and then the buyer goes away. But I think that they've shown interest, and I think there'll be a middle ground. I think there's a chance the offer is going to go up, and it won't be. I don't think it's going to be thwarted by another major shareholder blocking it, like Treat did, which happened, and also happened with Auction Technology, didn't it? The major investor blocking it. So,
I mean, the market price, this was up about an hour ago. The market price was £1.09. So that's tuppence below the bid, which kind of means the market's saying, okay, yes, there could be a higher bid coming in. If it was me, given how nervous markets are at the moment and technology type investments have plummeted recently, if it was me personally, I'd bank the money and run.
Yeah,
but you can always do half, can't you? It's not a binary decision. People can just sell half and then maybe run the other half. I don't know, but I can't imagine a bid getting anywhere close to NAV. And the other thing you could do is do a sum of the parts valuation yourself, isn't it? Look at all the individual investments and then form a view on that basis. So if you think, you know, this is a cheeky underpriced bid, then obviously you'd reject it. But personally, I think it was me, I'd just grab the money.
Yeah, I think if I was a shareholder, I'd actually contact the CEO and the chairman and see what he says and just say, look, why did you agree this at such a big discount to NAV? Because it looks optically very cheap. Yeah. And let them come out with some explanation, because it seems as though they're not doing shareholders the best service unless they know something that actually those NAVs are not as solid as they imagined. But interesting
situation. Yeah. Hmm.
Okay, we've got Rebecca. She's asking about a company, I think, that crashed a bit, unfortunately, this morning, ME Group, which basically does those automatic sort of like washing machines and also does the photo booths. I believe about 2 weeks ago, the son took over from the CEO or chairman as being the CEO. And then this morning, because I think the main listed, aren't they? They couldn't get their audit out for end of October. And so consequently, they're going to have the shares suspended. But the shares are down 13%. What was your take on it?
Well, we've spent quite a bit of time on this morning. My colleague John did a lot of digging on it. And basically, my view first thing was that I think it opened down 17% or something. And it was still, it tried to bounce. And then it was still down 13% about an hour ago or so. And I said to the team, look, whenever that happens, because it's an inline, they put in an inline trading update with saying there's nothing serious here. The auditors just need more time, basically. And I believe it sort of gave them a bit of a public criticism for that. But they said, you know, we've not been alerted to anything problematic in the audit, anything material, or and that we confirmed trading was in line with guidance. So you would normally expect the market to just brush that off, which these things are quite common these days. They never used to be, but they are since COVID. And the market normally just dismisses it. But this plunging down 17% and then still down 10% by lunchtime, it almost always means that a premium broker slipped out a profit warning or some reduced guidance. And we're sniffing around trying to find that out. But it looks like that might be the case. Peel Hunt has been rumoured to have been behind a possible. The other thing that we were slightly concerned at was that they seem, and John checked all this, my colleague, and he reckoned that the buyback had been reduced quite substantially. A previously announced buyback was going to be, and they seem to have revised that in today's announcement. And unless maybe, I was wondering, maybe that's that they've done some of it already and it's a reduced number. So we're not entirely sure on that point. But I mean, it started off really cheap yesterday. Now it's another 13% cheaper. So I think it's probably also been caught in the downdraft of the AI scare trade. And shareholders have had a miserable time here in the last year. Shares have nearly peaked, halved from last summer's high. But we can only go on what the information we've got. You know, we're not trying to predict the future on my Substack. So based on the information we've got, we're staying positive on it. But obviously, we don't know what might come out of the woodwork, and the market seems very nervous about it. But it's a fundamentally very good business, very cash generative, has net cash on the balance sheet, lovely divvies, owner managed. You know, it's got a lot going for it, but the market just hates it.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're right. I mean, 10 times PE and about 5.5 times dividend yield. I mean, you raise a really, really good point, because I've been scratching my head. And if they actually have released effectively a profit downgrade through the brokers on this morning's announcement, which was adamant that it wasn't affecting, you know, the trading, etc., that would be really disingenuous in terms of me. I mean, that's really signaling, that's not giving the right signal whatsoever. So I would I personally think it's more just the long lines of people have, you know, they're going to get a share suspension and they're not happy about it.
Oh, but, yes, good point. Yeah, but they said it might be suspended for technical reasons for about 10 days till, I think, 3rd of March to 13th of March, I think, is the possible suspension. But that doesn't really matter. I mean, somebody, I think it was Rebecca, actually, funnily enough, pointed out to me something similar happened with Carclo.
Yeah.
Although that is much higher risk because that's got a really wobbly balance sheet, whereas Me Group is the opposite, very strong balance sheet. But that's suspended for a while because of late accounts. And it just came back and then rose. So I don't think the share suspension side would worry me personally, but I'm not the market. You know, other people you could have been unnerved by that.
So there's various
factors at play here, but I'm leaning personally towards seeing this as glass half full.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And I think the auditor, Mazars, has got form, hasn't it? Because you said, obviously, Carclo, they were also the auditor. And the other one they did in the last 12 months where they delayed the accounts was Anglo Eastern Plantations. So this is the third one. They've actually got a hat trick. And I don't think any of those, either of those two companies had a problem in terms of when they had delayed audit. So on the balance of probability, I'm with you. Unless one of the brokers have downgraded expectations for next year's, which I think is pretty damn naughty if that's been the case, which I just don't believe they would have done it. But if they have, then it, you're right. That's a really good avenue to research and just check. But if they haven't, I think it's, you know, I mean, I don't own the shares, but if I wanted to buy them, this would be the time to pick them up because 10 days being suspended is nothing.
Yeah, no, I agree with all of that. I mean, I like to, you know, with risk reward, we all have different ways of weighing it up, don't we? But for me, these sorts of slightly special situations where something's gone wrong, but you're not entirely sure what, I'm happy to punt on those if they're net cash. If you haven't got any worry at all about the bank or covenants or creditors, you know, when you've got a bulletproof balance sheet like Me Group has, you know, those are the ones I think to push the boat out a bit on.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's move to software and services. We've got Traxys, the hardware and software expert in all things, tracks and rail lines and traffic management and stuff like this. We spoke to their CEO not long ago, who had just taken over the reins, and he's an ex-private equity. And anyway, what was your take of the numbers? Because it's looking really interesting. The shares are up 10% on an inline trading update.
I thought it was very, very good, very reassuring because the shares are so bombed out. I mean, the key question we're all asking on software companies now is how embedded is that software? What moat do they have? And obviously the ones that are really selling and everything indiscriminately sold off in this AI scare. But the ones that I think are solidifying now and maybe even starting to bounce a bit are the ones where the market started to think, well, actually, they have got a moat. We'll come on to that in a bit with Cerulean, I'm sure. So I think with Traxys, it's very, very embedded in the UK rail software, which is fiendishly complex and has all these union agreements in different regions. I just don't think that's something that can be disintermediated. So I'm pretty positive on Traxys, actually. I put out an update this morning on it on my Substack saying that the inline trading update was good. The shares looked oversold. You've got £23 million net cash as at July, but it probably hasn't changed too much. There was also a contract win on its train dispatch software. So in the US, which it said was an important validation, which was announced today. So I think it's starting to actually show some early signs of maybe actually being able to resume growth. Now, if that's the case, it won't stay on a PE of 10 for much longer, will it? So I wish I'd bought some actually on the recent dip. We have been ringing, you know, flagging this share to people for a while, you and I both, as being good value. And I think this is justified today's 11% rise. I thought that was a reassuring update. Yeah, too embedded for an AI threat, I think.
Yeah, it was scarily that we're actually in agreement here, Paul. That's one of the first three shares almost. But I'm with you. I haven't got any spare cash, but it'd be right in my buying zone. When we spoke to David Frost, what I loved about the way he was talking about it was he was looking at the whole portfolio and he was going to reshape it. And his the sort of impression that I got from it, that there's a few there's a bit of non-core assets in that events business that he was going to dispose of. Right. And I think he's going to reshape that. And then likewise, he's probably going to do, because he's still got a 20 million of net cash. I mean, it's a fabulous balance sheet. I think he's going to do bolt-ons and a perfect acquisition. I mean, probably he's got a whole list of people he wants to, but Cordell would be lovely because you're picking it up at a really low valuation in track maintenance. It's got all of those lovely contracts or pilot agreements out in the States. There'll be perfect synergies and it'll add on a new sort of revenue stream and growth engine going forward. And it would help Cordell. So in fact, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, he could do it a bit of cash and a bit of shares because, you know.
Yeah, a bit of a merger almost.
I was really impressed by the CEO and I think he's got his, you know, private equity guy. He's come on board. He knows software. He knows, you know, sort of asset allocation. He knows value creation for shareholders. And I think if this is as bad, you know, because let's be clear about it, we still haven't got through this Great British Railway sort of hiatus because I think there's 17, was it train operating companies or something like that, or 20 or something, and only about five or six, half a dozen of them have been taken up by the government. So over the next 18 months, the rest are to form Great British Europe. And this is what's causing the hiatus in Spain because, you know, particularly on track monitoring, because what's the incentive for the track operating companies to basically invest in their infrastructure when they know they're going to lose ownership in 18 months or six? They're just not going to do it. So if this is the worst it's going to be for Traxys, and they're still hitting their numbers and we've got good cash, then this is the bottom of the market. And let's be clear about it, we're only deferring infrastructure spend. Once Great British Railway comes, they're going to have a real problem because unless they actually spend a shed load of money on the infrastructure and get it all seamless, which will be great for Traxys. Unless they do that, it's going to fall down and, you know, the public are going to be totally on their backs about it. So, yeah, I'm with you. I was very, very pleased, you know, to see it was an inline trading update and a contract win.
Yeah, exactly. And it does say something in today's Traxys update as well. I've just remembered it said something about that the remote condition monitoring stuff is bumping along the bottom, but that there's you know, that could be a good recovery area. And I did think, though, that I thought the train operating companies and the rail maintenance side were separate. Are they not?
No, okay, sorry. You've got your hardware, the actual rail track owns the infrastructure, yes, and they operate on top of it. But there's plenty of other effectively CapEx they're deferring because I think about 30% or 25%, if I remember from when we spoke to David, of their revenue, Traxys' revenue, comes from the train operating companies. So they're basically not spending on CapEx.
That's the software, though, surely, isn't it, mainly?
Well, I don't know how this rail monitoring is actually procured because I've got a suspicion. You might find that the operating companies are responsible for keeping them up to speed and telling Railtrack and then procuring Railtrack to fix it for them. I don't know how that actually works.
That'd be a good question for our next call with management. But I think certainly, given that I'm totally with you, I think we're probably at or near sort of a base level of profitability that it's not likely to dip below. I think they're very, very embedded and resilient. So I don't see AI as a threat for Traxys. So I think risk reward on this for a patient investor, I think it looks really good, actually, really positive. Yeah.
Good. Okay. Well, maybe we'll come to the next one where we'll disagree. Well, we got moneysupermarket.com. Moni, Colin's asking about it. Did they come out with results earlier on? These guys basically own, moneysupermarket.com. And the shares responded pretty well. They're up again 2%.
Yeah, 2 days ago this was. I'm just trying to refresh my memory on it. What happened? It was full year results to calendar 25. We're just coming into now the absolute deluge of calendar 25 year-end results coming out. Earnings per share, it's coming back to me. Yeah, earnings per share rose 5%. The PE is only 8.8 times. This was as of Monday, so I don't know what's happened in the 2 days since. In line with expectations for profits, also in line, it's trading in line for calendar 26, it said. The balance sheet's fine. It's capital light, but it doesn't have any debt, which is very, very different to Future Group, which, of course, owns GoCompare, which they've geared up to the eyeballs. to do overpriced buybacks, as it now turns out. So if you have to buy a price comparison website, Moni is definitely the one, the better one of the two, I think. And I think overall, and you're getting 8% yields with Moni. And there's absolutely no sign in the results or in the outlook of AI impacting it at all. In fact, there was a lot of stuff in their narrative. It's come back to me now. I've that compartment of my brain has unlocked because I read all the narrative looking for what are they saying about AI? Is this BS or is it, you know, they just trying to sound positive? But they actually gave really good examples of how they're using AI to reduce, automate things, reduce costs, and so on. So I'm actually leaning quite positively. Oh, well, I'm not that positively. I don't want to own any price comparison websites. But if you put a gun to my head and say buy one of them, it would probably be Moni. And I think these incumbents, you know, are going to fight tooth and nail to hang on to their market share. And they've got big budgets because they make huge profits. They can afford to automate things and actually embrace and use AI to build a bigger moat. So I think I'm swaying away from AI a bit at the moment, but tomorrow I'll probably be going back towards it. So who knows?
Well, this is the first time we're going to disagree because I think this is a value trap. And if you read, I know it was a bit hyperbole, but if you read this Citrini research report, which is actually on Substack, so anybody can do, it was put out at the weekend that sent all the US big software companies into tailspin. So it got a lot of sort of like, you know, airtime. But it basically what it does, it sort of like looks 3 years forward and says what might happen with the acceleration of AI adoption. And it specifically talks about price comparison websites. It doesn't name Moni or anything, but talks about intermediaries. Yeah. And it says it reckons by end of next year, or sorry, so the end of 2026, early 2027, it's sort of 12 months time, etc. A lot you'll see those numbers which don't yet factor in, you can't see any damage, you'll start seeing it. And that's because essentially you're going to get that whole disintermediation. And their argument is that the friction costs for consumers of using agentic AI or agents, etc., goes to zero. And the reason why if consumers use Money Supermarket and price comparison websites is because of the friction cost, because it's a complex sale and they can go to a website and it tells them what they think what is the best three or four people to do. But that's because we get tired. The consumers get tired, haven't got infinite amount of time and want to do it in 5 minutes. Whereas an agent has got 24/7 who never gets tired. And therefore those friction costs, which effectively price comparison websites, you know, make all their money on the back of it, are going to go to zero. And then you've got,
Well,
okay. Yeah,
but the thing is, the Money Supermarkets and the Go Compares and everything are paid in commission by the insurance companies, aren't they? So there's nothing that, you know, I wouldn't stop using Money Supermarket for my car insurance to go to ChatGPT unless it offered something better. So it would need the insurance companies to actually offer better deals to ChatGPT. But why would they do that?
Well, they're doing it already, aren't they? So if you're an insurer, yeah, if you're an insurer and you don't actually advertise on a price comparison website, you get a better deal. So effectively, there's plenty of them who don't go through a state. I mean, Ryanair doesn't do it, you know. Basically, they don't go onto these TripAdvisor.
No, that's right.
I think Aviva didn't used to do it either. There's a few. Direct Line was another one I didn't think it did car insurance. So anyway, you can debate it. I would agree on the timescales, but there's going to be extra supply of agentic AI and competition into it. And that was their thesis that friction cost is going to. And then the worst side of it, which was buried, not buried, but it was in the detail, etc., was their marketing costs to get people get some traffic into the website was up 20%. And that's because of AI, because the less blue links is happening on Google. And so people are paying more to get the same, essentially, to get, you know, on a cost per click basis. So your costs are going up and you're going to get increased competition. So this is where I think looking at the financials on a historical basis actually is not going to get you. This is where you need to have judgment. And if you judge it forward that they're not going to get disintermediated, then yes, I agree. The financials agree with it. But I think this is as a bigger value trap as you can possibly get, because it looks very cheap. But I think the E is coming down in 1, 2, 3 years. And it's superficially cheap, but in future, that ease is going to decrease.
That's an interesting idea. I mean, for me personally, my view is I think these businesses are much, much more robust. And the reason is, I think probably, I don't think blue clicks really matter. I think now, because we've had saturation advertising from price comparison websites for so many years, I suspect most people just have their go-to site. For me, I like the meerkats. So I go to Compare the Market. And I always get great deals on my car. I've got 3 cars. I always get great deals by going to them. There's nothing that would make me even consider going to get my car insurance any other way. It's just an automatic thing to me. Money Supermarket, you know, bang, bang, bang. And I think the customers are much, much stickier than AI fans potentially think. But I could be completely wrong. So none of us know for sure, do we?
Okay, what you should do, when we chat about it next, in between, go onto that US agentic AI app, which was Insurify, which came out about 3 weeks ago. And I know it's US car insurance, but they do effectively price comparison on a car insurance and just see what you get, basically. And just pretend to be a US, you know, basically car insurance purchase.
Yeah, that wouldn't work because I wouldn't know what the rate should be. So when it comes to the UK, maybe. But as Money Supermarket said, they are investing and putting in AI tools. So you can talk to Money Supermarket now in natural language. And we had something similar from Auto Trader. These guys are deploying AI themselves. They're not letting the grass grow under their feet. So as yet, I haven't actually seen anything unique or different or better that AI can do. But I do appreciate in this particular area, but I do appreciate it's very early days. So I reserve the right to completely do a 180 degrees at any point without notice.
That is fabulous. Love it. Okay, let's move.
That's one of the key skills in what we do in shares, changing your mind, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, we've got a couple of people asking about specialist industrial engineer. We've got Drew and Hope Valley, both asking about Avingtrans, which came out with first half results in line today with a very strong second half. I was looking at the shares, and in the last year, they've almost doubled. I mean, they've been driven by... They're driven by, you know, new nuclear, existing nuclear, defense, transport, medical, and I understand even in the detail that it was quantum computing as well. So anyway, what was your take on it?
Yeah, very good. We looked at these this morning on my Substack. My colleague Dave knows a bit about this one, so he wrote up a section on it. He sounded a bit lukewarm, but we're actually Amber Green, which is our 4 out of 5 star rating. It's positive. It was, I mean, very, very nice results. H1 results were out this morning to November 25. PBT was up 27%. So, I mean, that is really good. And the full year, it says it's got 95% visibility for May 2026. And big EPS is jumping up in strides for the reason you say it's got various industry tailwinds. It's a kind of mini conglomerate, a sort of buy, improve and sell type group with very well-regarded management at Avingtrans, and it's really firing on all cylinders. Not much debt, balance sheet's all right. A forward PE is about 19 times. We think it's probably maybe in the short term up with events. It's had a terrific run, this share has, and in this type of market, people are banking profits, aren't they? So I think it depends entirely on your time frame. If you're a long-term holder, you probably are likely to want to keep this for more upside. If you're, you know, a shorter term type trader stroke investor, you might well be banking some profits now. So or around that, I quite like top slicing when something shot up a lot. I've had a few of those, like most people have in the last few months. I think there's no harm at all in banking some profits. Then you've got some money to put into other things. But overall, we think the story at Avingtrans is really good. We're a bit slow to the party on it. We only changed from neutral to positive in at the beginning of September last year on the basis of those nuclear contracts it won. When we saw that, when people explained to us about the medical division losses reducing, that the penny dropped with me, and I thought, actually, this is better than it looks. And the broker forecasts have risen a hell of a lot in the last 4 months or so. So it's going very well. So well done to people who were ahead of the game on Avingtrans. Looks good.
Yeah, well, I actually interviewed the CEO and the CFO this morning, okay? And
Oh, did you?
And they are very, very positive. Not surprisingly, obviously, you know, any management team would be. But the big drivers are new nuclear, okay? They got this flagship $10 million contract with TerraPower, who inked a deal with Meta to do effectively billions and tens of billions of pounds of investment of new nuclear facilities in the States. Wow. And having done effectively the first pilot power station, new nuclear power station for Bill Gates's TerraPower, they're going to get all of those. They're very likely to get all of those. And that was just $10 million, and it's increasing for that pilot. It's just the start. Yeah. It's just basically just waiting to put the whole lot. So I would, and then the other one they inked the deal was with Oklo, and they mentioned that in the video, and also GE and Westinghouse. So new nuclear, I think, could go into triple figures in terms of order book. Now, that is absolutely fabulous, okay? Because the main company in that, or the main subsidiary, is Haywood Tyler, who they bought about 5 or 6 years ago, and now would be coming up to be sold. But now it's given them a problem because they don't realize they're sort of umming and ahhing about when they want to sell that business, because it's just going absolute gangbuster in new nuclear. And these are really, really big long-term contracts. And then the other one is they've got Ormandy, which again has come up to that sort of 5 or 6 year period. And these guys do HVAC for data centers, specializing in water cooled, data. That means if you've got water cooled, it's far more efficient than air cooled when you can put more, basically, you know, NVIDIA chips in there. So they're having an absolute gangbuster, and that's given them a nice quality problem to have. And then the other side of the coin, they've got this medical division with the 3D x-rays and the 3D MRIs, but also hidden in there, which is the first time they've talked about, is SciMed, which basically does cryogenic facilities or products that help effectively freeze quantum computing machines, basically, to absolute zero. And that could well be spun off later on. So I was counting it up, and most companies are lucky to have one tailwind. These guys have got six.
Well, do you know what? This is starting to sound like another Goodwin.
Yes, that was what I was thinking. Just don't be surprised. These are long-term niche things that we've basically got, you know, UK essentially, you know, sort of expertise in it that in the worldwide they haven't got any at all. And I asked him also, okay, right, tell me, they're two Steves, but Steve McQuillan's the CEO. And I said, Steve, you're telling me, you know, it's dead boy. Have you got enough capacity? And then he basically talks about, well, actually, we're looking at increasing the capacity up in Michigan in the States, because we're getting so much demand. We don't want to turn orders away, but that may well be the case. So, yeah, I'm with you. I think there are similarities of Goodwin in this, because
I might have to pick some up when I can find some money. And obviously, based on what you've said, you want them to ditch the buy and improve and sell strategy and just run these things, you know, run them long term.
I personally would do, yes, but hey, you know, they've got bigger shareholders. Harwood are all over this, and they've been there for a long time. So I don't know what
that sounds really interesting. Thanks for heads up on that, Paul. I should emphasize to people listening, we don't confer. So Paul and I, this is a kind of live chat between two real world investors. We're not, it's not scripted. So yeah, interesting.
Yep. Okay, good. Well, let's talk about Cerillion, probably one of the highest, if not the highest quality, small cap software company in the UK. It basically does software for big telcos, not for the like. I mean, basically, it does like O2 and Vodafone, but not in the UK. They'll do them elsewhere in the world. Like they won a big $42 million contract with Omantel, only just recently their biggest ever. The shares have done fabulously. We spoke to the CEO and the CFO yesterday. Do you want to fill people in on what we found?
Oh, yeah, I'm in serious danger of falling in love with the share. I kind of have been for a while. I've been very, very positive about Cerillion. It's a cracking business. It does basically the billing element of telecoms companies. That's its main niche. And you'll see if you look at the historical figures for it, profitability was you know, it was a tiny niche business in 2020. Since then, as the share price is reflected, as you've got on screen there, it's done just exponential rises in profitability as they keep winning. And it's a snowball effect. They keep winning bigger and bigger contracts because each larger contract then becomes a reference contract, which gives more, and it's international. It's just a lovely, lovely business. The main downside risk on it, well, two. One is valuation. It is tricky to value. The second thing is optically, it looks like the growth has slowed or even stalled. But I think the pipeline is sufficiently good that it'll probably, growth will probably reaccelerate, I think. And you don't have that much recurring revenue here for a software company. It's only, I think even with adjustments, it's only for about 45%. So I did ask management, you know, well, what happens if inevitably there's a gap in the order book, you know, where you have a year where you don't manage to land several bigger and bigger contracts. And they didn't really give a particularly clear answer to that. So that remains a little bit of a question with me. So I think there's always a risk with this thing that you might just suddenly get a profit warning and it drops sharply, but that would be a back up the truck buying opportunity, you know? I think the founder did bank quite a substantial amount with a recent director sale at £15 as well. But those are really the only negatives I can find. And I don't think they actually matter that much. The positives of this, it's just that very rare thing, a genuine UK rapid organic growth company, which is not necessarily showing in the current numbers, but as new contracts are won. I mean, he's talking about what amazed me as well. He said, sorry, I'm going on a bit here, but what amazed me was I said, you know, what's the end game? And he said, well, we reckon medium term we can get to 100 million revenues. I'm sure that's public knowledge. I think that's out.
Which is double, the current,
which is double. Yeah. And it's huge margins. It's 40-odd, 50-odd% operating margins. So it could even be higher margin. Owner managed business, you see, they keep the cost down, they don't dilute. But he then said the next stage from that, he said, would be us achieving critical mass. He said the next stage to go from 100 million revenue to say 500 million revenue would be easier. Well, I nearly fell off my chair. I thought he misspoke. So we had to query him on that. But that's how bullish they are long, long term. Yeah. So I think it's a very, very interesting. And they're winning these bigger contracts internationally in full competitive tender processes against the world's giants, including Huawei and Netcracker, wasn't it? Yeah. Sorry. So I think it's a very impressive business, but I don't really know how to value the shares, I'm afraid.
Yeah. I'm totally with you. I think it's so entrenched within these massive telcos. And these, you've got to just picture it, these telcos will operate, will have 15, 20 million subscribers, okay? Huge amounts of complexity. And no, they're not going to. This is an operational system, not only on the billing, but it also does it links in with the operation. So it's got all the pipes to get all the data and the APIs throughout the whole company, effectively, to be able to do the provisioning of services, plus the, like, you know, do mobile, you do broadband, you do, you know, basically maybe in a fixed line and streaming, and specifically to each customer. So it does all the provisioning as well as doing obviously all the billing as well. So it's massively entrenched. It isn't going to be disintermediated by AI at all. This is the last one that would do, I'm sure. It's so entrenched. And its USP is that its cost of ownership appears to be so much lower than its competition, because it's all in the cloud. It's simply done as in, like, you know, configured, rather than huge amounts of sort of like, you know, systems and different interfaces.
Yeah,
and all this
standardized, sort of stuff, isn't it? Whereas the competitors offer, he was saying that the customers have got wise to the fact that some competitors offer an optically very cheap initial price, but the total cost of ownership will be much bigger because you have to have an army of sort of programmers and bespokers there. Also, you grilled him, as you always do in these joint chats we have. It's excellent. You really did grill him on AI. And I thought he was very open about this. He said, look, he said, you can use AI to do, I think he said, 80 to 85% of what Salesforce does. But he says the problem is, for lots of businesses, and especially with telecoms billing, 85% doesn't cut the mustard. He said it's got to be 100%. Yeah. Everything has to be absolutely 100%. And you cannot, he said, I think his exact words were, AI is a long way from doing that. So these guys are really entrenched. Also, they said a major customer that wants to leave, he said churn just doesn't happen. They more or less, they said it's extremely rare for a customer to leave us. He said if a large customer were to leave us, he said them disentangling and moving to a new provider would take about 3 years. So these are super, super sticky contracts, and they land and expand with these contracts as well. Quietly very bullish, I think, these guys.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the switching costs are absolutely massive. And to reiterate, that sort of cost of ownership is a lot lower. There's two pieces of evidence. When they won Virgin Island about a year ago or the last 12 months, They kicked out Amdocs. They basically, that was the incumbent who were the number one player worldwide. So they kicked out the number one player, the biggest one, yeah? And then for the Omartel, they kicked out Optiva, which is another sort of, and on that they beat, you say, Nutcracker, and they beat Huawei went on a head-to-head. So that tells you that they've got that product price mix perfectly. And then the other anecdotal evidence is that when I was asking him about how does a big contract like Omartel split in terms of recurring revenues and software. About a third of it's implementation, 18 months. And I said to him, is that low gross margin? And he was like, And then I looked at the gross margin for the company overall. It's 80%, okay? So actually what happens, because they price it to effectively just below what everybody else prices doing an implementation, but because their system isn't as simple and as easy to configure and not all cloud-based, then they have bigger implementation costs, switch changing costs, etc. So they can basically price it below what everybody else and still make a really, really good gross margin because their system is so much better designed. So, I mean, I think we both come to the same conclusion. What a fab business. Yes. I mean, the software is I would love to own it, but I haven't got any money at the moment. But it is same here. Yeah,
it would be a great business. This is probably right at the top of my buy the dips list. You know, if some news came out that, oh dear, we've had a bit of a glitch or blah, 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 depending on the precise details, you know, any shop, because it's quite an illiquid, it's very tightly held share. So as you can see from the share price graph, you know, it can move in hundreds of pence in big sudden moves if the market doesn't like something. And if a big contract comes up, it can go up vertically. So I think it's one of those ones to just have on your watch list for things that you know is a really, really nice share to buy and then plunge in, you know, on the dips. That's what I'm hoping to be able to do at some point. So, yeah, loved it. It was a really good call, wasn't it? Excellent. Yeah. Not flashy management. They're just down-to-earth, hands-on entrepreneurs just getting on with building a terrific business, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. Okay, we've got a quick question from Gibson. He's asking about my latest thoughts on Spire Healthcare. It's in this bid, basically. It's in this bid with... it's run an auction process and it's got two private equity guys who are looking at it, Bridgepoint and Triton, I think it is. And bids need to come in by the end of March, etc. Now, he's asking why the shares are going down. That's an easy one, okay? The reason why the shares are falling is that you've probably read in the press over the last 2 weeks is that the NHS's biggest supplier of joint cement, and when I medical joints, so hips and knees, sterile cement that you can put effectively the artificial joint into somebody. Now the big factory they all use has had a problem on their production, and so what that meant is that in the NHS has basically deferred operations only other than an emergency to save supplies, and it also will impact the private guys, the likes of Spire and with Circle. So that's why people are sort of a bit reticent, saying, in that case, they're not going to hit their numbers by the end of March, okay, when it comes to sort of they're going to have a profit warning. Whether that makes massive difference to the bid, I don't know, because effectively we're only deferring operations. We're not cancelling operations. And also this morning on the BBC, the NHS has actually got a couple of other suppliers now on board that will help them and the other private players get some more effectively joint cement to be able to do the hips and joints, because hips and joint operations, because Spire Healthcare, that's their bread and butter sort of stuff. So the answer to your question is essentially, I'm still positive. I still own shares. I still think it will go above 250 if they put a bid, and I still believe with private equity guys they will put a bid on it. But the market is selling them off because of they're not going to meet their expectations because of the one-off shortage of sterile joint cement, which is the biggest supplier to the UK, is in Germany, and they've had a production problem for 2 months.
And I think you've also got a deal risk must have increased, mustn't it? I mean, that's what the share price is telling us, that it sounds like this bid probably won't go ahead. That's what the market thinks anyway.
I don't think it's significantly increased, but if you got to, I don't know, let's see anyway. Okay, yeah. Good. We've got Nick asking about student real estate and developer accommodation developer Unite Group, which came out with sort of like I think it was quite weak results. They just bought Empiric, haven't they?
That's right. We looked at this. I think it was yesterday.
What's your take on their performance? Because I think they're struggling with vacancies, aren't they? In certain cities like Sheffield, Leicester, Nottingham, I think. And they've just bought Empiric, who have more problems with vacancies than they do.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert on this one by any means, but I had a quick look at the results yesterday, and the calendar 25 results were fine. EPS was up 2%. The divvies, you've got a very, very attractive dividend yield, which actually will have gone up now as the shares dropped. Yeah, I think it's just over 7% now, the dividend yield on this. They're doing a disposal to raise some cash, but the loan to value is modest, only 27%. Huge discount to NAV now. You're paying not much above half NAV. So the market clearly doesn't believe the NAV, but that does seem a very extreme discount to me. So I think it looks interesting value right now. So I'm quite positive on Unite. But yeah, in terms of why did the shares drop 14% yesterday, then you're right. It was a mild profit warning, basically. They said, quote, income expected at lower end of the range. That's for calendar 2026. And I think you're right. I think it seemed to be mainly due to issues at Empiric. I don't know when that deal completed, whether that would have been in the 2025 numbers or not. That's my only query on this one. But I think it's definitely worth having a look at.
Yeah, I don't think it was in the historic ones. It's in the forward ones, basically, because of the blend. Yeah. Blended vacancies. And I think you're also having more students staying at home now in the UK rather than that's ticking up. So it's taking some of the demand away. I would say when it comes to looking at sort of NAV, you know, if you want to sort of view it as a sort of like a margin of safety, don't just look at it at the NAV discount. I know it's massive here, so it doesn't really make much difference. But the way you should really, if it's got some loan to value, which I think was about 27% in this case,
27%, yeah.
To give yourself a margin, a sort of indicative level of margin of safety on what gross assets need to fall to effectively get down to the share price. Then you need to do it on an enterprise value basis. So essentially, with like the 50% discount to NAV translates to a roughly around about 36 or 37% discount to gross assets. But that's still massive. What you're saying is that the share price is saying, on a gross asset basis, the assets are worth a third of what they, you know, over a third of what they're currently, the share price is showing. So you've got a huge, either way you look at it, you've got a huge margin of safety.
Yeah, and I think these EPRA valuations really need to be closely inspected, because they don't seem to be giving sort of particularly accurate results. And if these properties are only, basically the market's saying these properties are probably only worth half what they're in the books at, which I mean is crazy, isn't it? You know, one needs to be addressed one either way. I mean, and it did have 95% occupancy in calendar 2025, so the core business looks pretty good to me. So I think it's interesting value. Yeah, but you're right. You'd need to get into the weeds and really understand. It'd be interesting to get some independent valuations on each individual site, wouldn't it? Maybe on a couple of them, a sample of them. Get an expert to tell us, are those valuations reasonable or are they inflated? You know, what would somebody on the open market actually pay for that building? That's what matters. matters ultimately, isn't it? Not what somebody assesses its value to be.
Okay, good. Let's move back to technology. We've got Pulsar Group. We've got Anne asking about it. These guys basically do software for communications, so they and marketing essentially. I think that they effectively allow companies to do. They've got a dashboard sort of system that picks up how adverts of sort of like and media campaigns have performed and tells them, right. Gives them stats about the effectiveness of it, etc. Which is a software system in name, I suppose. But what's your take? I think they came out with some results or something this week.
Yeah, I mean, we've been consistently negative on this since I started my Substack in November 2024, mainly actually because of the balance sheet weakness. It's got a negative £26 million net tangible asset value. It doesn't tend to matter that much for software companies, though, so maybe we've been a bit harsh on that. But yeah, put out a full year trading update, 97% recurring revenues, which is pretty impressive, actually, isn't it? EBITDA up 13%, but of course EBITDA is a nonsense number at software companies because of the half the payroll bypasses the P&L, doesn't it, going into intangible assets. I mean, Cavendish have got 2.2p and 3.1p as earnings forecasts, so PE of 15 for next year's figures. I don't know, with a weak balance sheet, I don't know. I haven't looked into it in that much detail, yeah. But I can't really see anything much to particularly engage my interest on this one. It sounds like you know more about it than I do, Paul. So over to you.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a look at it on a software basis, and it trades at about 1.1 times sales, or less now, actually, going forward. But yeah. It only makes like 6%, 6.5% EBIT margins. I mean, I would say this is a software company by name, but we're only talking about dashboards and getting – it's basically a database with a user, you know, sort of interface at the top to be able to help people in marketing about, like, you know, to make better marketing decisions. And I think this is right in the crosshairs of agentic AI and other systems. It's not an entrenched B2B system. This is a sort of like a department or a person type of, you know, help system that allows you to do stats basically and to do KPIs and this sort of stuff. And yes, if you're a user and you're used to using it, then you don't want to lose it. And it's probably sold as a cloud SaaS provider. But I think this is right. I personally wouldn't go into a software company like this because I think it's definitely something that would be struggling against. Effectively an agentic bot that could do reports and can do collection of stats quite easily because it's a single person solution basically or a little team solution.
Right. Okay. So yeah, it might be the type of thing, maybe the number. There's a lot of people are selling off software companies which have a sort of per seat charging model, don't they? Because they think with AI automating things, there'll be far fewer people requiring seats. But I mean, 61 million a year revenue, 97% recurring. It's not bad, is it? That's a reasonable sized business. But maybe they need to strip out a ton of cost because one of the opportunities right now, I think, for smaller software companies, and we've had one or two come through and say this, is that they can slash their developer teams because so much of it is now being automated. So you might suddenly see some of these software companies, suddenly the profitability going through the roof. If they've got the sticky recurring revenues and they can now, you know, let half of their developers go, that could be very good for some of these software companies.
Yeah. No, I mean, as I mentioned yesterday to Cerillion, I mean, I was interviewing Paul Jordan on Monday and he was talking about Trainline. In fact, we should cover Trainline.
Let's talk about that one.
It is, yeah. Anyway, Paul Jordan was talking about Trainline and he owns it. And he basically said he wants them to essentially, you know, replace a lot of their 600, which he called a Rolls-Royce level of software developers, replace some of them with agentic AI and reduce the cost, which would be illustrated. But anyway, yeah, let's move to Trainline because I think their CEO left, haven't they? And it didn't help the price this morning.
No, it came up on my sort of mid-morning trawl of the percentage movers of the whole market, which I do on ShareScope every day, multiple times. And yeah, up came a Trainline, down 7%. out of the blue, it's announced the departure of the CEO, Jody Ford, which is actually a man, not a woman, intends to step down, but it sounds orderly. It basically said that the chairman has suggested it's time for new leadership and that they're going to do it in an orderly handover. So that in itself, I find reassuring in that it's not, oh my God, something awful's happened, and do you know what I mean? And they've been kicked out and frog marched out of the building. So it seems to be a fairly orderly situation. Mr. Ford is staying on for an orderly handover, it says, and they're going to start a search for a replacement. Doesn't really give the reasons why they think they need new leadership, but it did put in a impromptu trading update saying it reconfirms the previously upgraded market guidance for February 2026 year end. So that is quite reassuring, isn't it? Which by my reckoning, on consensus EPS of just over 22p, that means Trainline's on a current year PE ratio of only 8.6 times, which I mean is really low, isn't it? I mean, it does have a horrible balance sheet. That's the only other thing to mention, with a fair bit of debt. But this is another one where the market is clearly valuing this for some sort of very significant AI disintermediation, isn't it? And I would say I've never been convinced that Trainline has much of a moat. So, I am resisting the urge to buy some of these. We've got lots of falling knives, lots and lots of falling knives to pick and choose through at the moment. And I'm resisting all of them. I want to see where the dust settles, and I'll miss out on I don't think there's going to be a V-shaped recovery with this AI scare stuff. I think you'll get some nice bounces, trading bounces, but I cannot see these things going all the way back up to previous valuations. I mean, what do you feel, Paul?
Yeah, I'm with you. I think this is another value trap, unfortunately, simply because you've got Great British Railway, which is going to be, you know, they're creating their own competitive app, etc. It has been talked about that Trainline will white label their facility into in Great, which wouldn't be great for them because that mean that they're where, yeah, that you'd split the profits of their existing business. But actually, Paul Jordan reckons the Great British Railway, given but is owned by the government, will absolutely not use Trainlines. And on that basis, then they shouldn't do it. But let's be clear, there's got to be a temptation if you're the Great British Railway to essentially do, you know, basically no commission whatsoever ticketing prices and just make the money on the actual trains. And therefore, all that modus operandi and consumer inertia, which is what Trainline play off, is going to really struggle. So I think they're going to have a problem.
Yeah, when I was looking through the accounts for Trainline a few days ago, I thought, well, let's try it out to see what USP, if any, it's got. And it seems to be about split ticketing. Yes. I booked tickets from Bournemouth to Birmingham New Street Station for the Mellow Conference in April, and it did all this split ticketing. But then I went onto National Rail's own website to see the exact same trains, and it was basically the same price. I think a Trainline was about £2 cheaper. So I'm not really sure why anyone would book through Trainline as opposed to just going to National Rail's website. So I don't get what its moat is or why people use it, really. Obviously, I'm missing something, but it doesn't seem to me that this is necessarily a particularly sticky business. So, yeah, I'm avoiding it.
Yeah. So you're going to Mellow, are you, in April? Coming down my neck of the woods in Birmingham. Are you presenting or are you just obviously rolling out doing the...
I probably won't be. Yeah, I think I'm on the bash panel. That's nice and easy. Nice, you can just blag it. You don't have to do any presentation, preparation. Lovely. But I'm going to be also promoting my Substack and giving out lots of free pens. Also, I'm getting some Pauly Pilot poo bags made up for the dog walkers. So I'll give out branded poo bag holders. So I thought that'd be a nice little thing to reward my podcast dog walking listeners.
Well, if you haven't got to get back, you just stay over at my place because I'm presenting in Birmingham as well in the morning.
Oh, excellent. Thanks,
and if you, and maybe we get absolutely ratted with everybody else on the Thursday, on that Wednesday night.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a given, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I'm mystery shopping the Easy Hotel.
Mine's even cheaper.
Yours is more luxurious, is it?
My house is even cheaper. Anyway, it's up to you.
Thanks for the offer.
But that'll be great. Okay, yeah. Let's move on. We've got Rebecca. She's asking about Jet 2, the old holidays and airline. I think basically they came out with results or a trading update. They've got a new base coming in Gatwick, I believe, which is going to be a bit of extra cost. They've got more capacity coming on for their winter and summer season, I believe, which they need to sell because of obviously people having later bookings than they've done over the last few years when they've been in lockdown. But anyway, putting all that together, their shares are very cheap. What's your sort of view on Jet 2?
Yeah, I love this one. I did buy some recently. I'll tell you why, because the really, really poor winter spring weather so far in the UK, everybody's booking hot. Well, look at me. I'm out of multiples. I got so sick of the British weather working remotely. And lots of people apparently are now booking quick breaks. You know, the summer holiday seems to be a sort of, you know, seen more as an essential by a lot of people, but they are booking them closer to the dates because there's plenty of capacity. I mean, it's so cheap, this thing is. I mean, it was in line with expectations today, which when you're on a PE of 6, the market's baking in, you know, downside risk, isn't it? Gatwick could be very significant, of course. No clear guidance. We're not particularly keen on the outlook comments from Jet2. Tends to be detail that you don't really need, and it doesn't pull it together with an overview. Amazing balance sheet, almost fully asset-backed. So I really like it, but I did cross-check it with, it's like doors to cross-check, isn't it? I did cross-check it with EasyJet, which is similarly very, very cheap. Yeah. So you've got obviously sector risks, you know, wars, famines, pandemics, you've got all those sorts of risks, but everything's got its price. And when these things have got such great balance sheets as well, and you look at Jet 2, zoom out on the chart, this has been a major multi-bagger long term. I love it. I just think it's dirt cheap. So yeah, that's why I bought some.
Yeah, I think the one thing just to be aware of with all these airlines, even though they've got lots of cash, I understand that Jet 2 has got quite a relatively old air fleet. And the problem with air fleets, with their
does
old...
Does it? Are you sure about that?
Yeah, well, that's what Paul Jordan of Amati told me anyway when we discussed it. And the problem if you have a relatively old fleet is not only the consumption of air jet fuel, which is a third of their cost, you know, sort of like making it competitive, but also now you get lots of these... you have to pay carbon obligations. So it's not only the jet fuel. Yet the more less efficient your engine, the more carbon charges, your fees you've got to pay as well. So I would just have a look at how much
I'll double check that. Yeah,
new CapEx.
I mean, they talked today about the Neo 321, is it, planes?
Yeah,
that they've I think they've got a huge order for brand new planes already in the pipeline.
Yes,
I believe so. And of course, as you say, the new planes are so much more fuel efficient that actually the total cost of ownership is probably cheaper with those. So, but yeah, I'll double check that at some point. Thanks for the heads up, Paul.
Okay, we've got Yolandi's asking about war paint. He's basically saying, because I think they went up just recently on the back of probably Cockney Rebel saying he loves the stock. and they've now started to come down. But anyway, what's your take on your latest thoughts on the cosmetics challenger brand war paint?
Yeah, I mean, I obviously liked it when it was growing rapidly and profits were shooting up, but then the facts changed. So I became less keen on it when it started shrinking instead of growing. It did put out, well, two profit warnings, once on the 10th of September and once on the 9th of February, just gone. But the most recent profit warning actually was combined with some reasonably upbeat positive outlook comments about, they gave us some specifics, for example, further customer rollouts into new retail sites it flagged, and higher margins coming through because I would assume because of the Chinese factories offering better prices and the Forex market being favorable. So I think it's down but not out. Still a very nice owner-managed business. I think some of the gloom was maybe a bit overdone. I think the bounce from about £1.90 to up to about £2.70 very recently itself was a little bit overdone. So I think it's retraced. I think a few people have probably quite sensibly banked those profits. But you know, it's fundamentally a pretty good business. It's got net cash of 18 million, which is about 10% of the market cap. So I quite like it. But I think given that we're not really sure if is it still growing or has it matured or declining? I mean, you, I think, have flagged a lot of the competitive pressures in makeup when we've talked about this previously. So I'm kind of on the fence with it, ish. Actually, no, I'm not. I'm amber green. That means that was when at £2.21 I was amber green. So probably at £2.70 I'd move to amber. Just down a bit. I need a little bit more evidence of what's actually going on. Is it fundamentally, have we reached peak war paint or is it just a bump in the road? And at the moment, I don't know. We time will tell.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, you did some great digging with the CEO about a year ago, 6 months ago, when you interviewed him, because you sort of delved into his customer concentration. And I can remember you basically, they've got a big customer, haven't they, in Scandinavia and across Europe, and it counts like 40% of revenues. And I just thought, if that ever goes pear-shaped for whatever reason, which is unlikely to, but if it ever did, I mean, that's just a huge effectively dependency on one client.
Exactly. That was a big risk that I hadn't previously been aware of, which shows how superficial my research is, because I should have known that, because it's usually buried in the annual reports, isn't it? Mm. Somewhere in the receivables notes or whatever, it would normally tell you of client concentration risk. But that's always a great question to ask management if you get to talk to them, I think.
Good. Okay, let's move over to we've got surveillance and CCTV sort of systems, Synetics. We've got David asking about it, because I think they won some contracts, didn't they, just recently? I thought this week they announced a few. But there's no broken oats out, so it's difficult to understand what's your view on it.
Only amber on it, which is 3 out of 5, because that's just a don't know. As you say, we've got no broker coverage. They don't communicate well with the market, I feel. It's like the last RNS was 2 days ago, ongoing new business momentum, but tell us about a couple of contract wins, but no figures. Mm. Now, I appreciate that might be commercially sensitive and whatnot. So, I mean, it looks a pretty reasonably good business, subject to large individual contracts, though. That's why it dropped sharply recently, because they completed one big contract and that dropped the order book down by about a third. So obviously people didn't like that. And project delays in the oil and gas, which was its traditional sector where it used to specialize, but it's since branched out into casinos, I think, and one or two other areas. So we like it. We love the balance sheet. 14 million net cash. That's as at November 2025. But I don't think you'll get onto I don't see any real reason why the shares would want to go up much in this just this absence of information really from the company, and also, you know, the large lumpy contracts issue, which is inherent in the business model. So I don't think businesses like this really should trade on much more than a PE of 10, 11, 12. Difficult to value, isn't it?
Yeah, and when they haven't got any numbers out in the market, it's almost impossible, because what that says is that they're not confident to what indirectly tells me anyway is essentially probably there's a likelihood of a profit warning. I know they haven't got effect, but there's a profit reset which is coming, and they're not sure about how far it is going to go down from the previous year when they had these large contracts. So I think that's what stopped a lot of professional people interested in buying. They're just going to wait until the dust settles, get this next trading update out of the way, and see where the business lies. But it's flagged to me what you said is lumpy large contracts. It depends on order book conversion, and they haven't got enough visibility at the moment to put some firm numbers out there. And it just means that it's a bit of a buyer's strike. So if you wanted to be bullish, you would say, okay, there's a lot of really critical infrastructure now that needs new CCTV, things like, you know, basically nuclear facilities and a whole bunch of, you know, anything where there's power, train station, anything, there's lots of critical infrastructure that hasn't got yet CCTV in around the world that actually does need it. That'd be the bull case.
It would. And of course, there's a lot of stuff in the press now, isn't there, about how Russia is apparently infiltrating Western countries and renting or buying properties near military bases in order to spy and to potentially launch low-level deniable sabotage and attacks and things, which does make you think there's going to be a much, much greater need for CCTV. But what is Synectic's USP? You know, installing CCTV systems is a pretty generic activity. Now, clearly, they've got some expertise in particular verticals, the casinos and the oil and gas in particular, but I don't know. To me, there's never quite enough of a hook here for me want to get involved. And it's a very illiquid share as well. So, you know, you basically your first year's dividends will probably go just in paying the bid offer spread. I'm pretty sure it's a dividend payer, isn't it? But for me, I'd probably want it on an absolutely dirt cheap valuation to want to interest me. And I can't really see that at the moment.
Yeah, okay. All right, let's move to another. We've got Rachel. We were talking about a company that we've never talked about. It's Checkit, basically, does automated monitoring and operational sort of intelligence platform for sort of Internet of Things and monitoring fridges and stuff like that. What's your sort of take on this business? The shares over 5 years haven't done so well, but they have improved over the last sort of like year or so.
This was a very interesting one. We looked at it last week, actually, on my Substack, and we've been quite dismissive of it in the past because of, it was very heavily loss-making and cash-burning, and it looked as if it was just inexorably heading for the knacker's yard, really, but they've really turned it around. So this is worth a fresh look with fresh eyes, I think. Have a look at the trading update for 12 months to January 26, which came out on the 19th of February. Ahead of expectations and break-even adjusted EBITDA, it's now reached. And it's delivered, get this, £4 million worth of annual cost savings. And this is a business with revenue of only about 12 or 13 million. So they must have absolutely slashed their costs. And they actually generated costs in cash in H2. And I think this was the one where they said we've been able to decimate our developers' costs because we're doing it with AI now. So this, I'm pretty sure this was the one which really made my ears prick up and thought, that's why I think there's wider read across, possibly, for smaller software companies that have traditionally lost money. They might suddenly, because apparently everyone's doing the coding now with Claude, I think it is, isn't it, or whatever.
Anthropic.
And, this is one of the first examples I've seen of a software company, able to massively reduce its costs and say, look, we can still do the work, but we don't need the people. So this is very interesting. We need to keep our eyes peeled for more situations like that. The problem with Checkit is lack of top line growth. So I think now they've right-sized their overheads. Yeah. The next thing to get it to move up significantly again, I think it will need to start generating better top line growth. It does sort of monitoring, as you say, Internet of Things for various systems. Potentially interesting, I would say, worth people having a look at. I don't own any myself, but I think it's just got a lot more interesting because of the cash burn's been resolved.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would say it looks to me, with Internet of Things and device monitoring, it looks a bit and sounds a bit like Vianet. And, you know, you obviously...
I was just about to say that. They make out their Internet of Things, but actually these things are just, you know, sensors that have been rigged up to the internet for 20 years. It's not necessarily cutting edge at all.
I know. So I think that you've nailed it, basically. The key KPI, if you're interested in it, is looking at organic growth, because Brewlines and Vianet have struggled with organic growth for as long as I've known the company, which is 25 years.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Because it was...
Oh, Top Dogger just says Jet2 definitely has an aging fleet. Thank you, Top Dogger. That's useful to know.
Yeah, it's good, yeah. Okay, we've got the last one. Let's go for SDI, which is basically a buy and build sort of like instrumentation company that sells equipment into research and labs and this sort of stuff. Amanda's basically asking about what's sort of the latest views on it. High quality company, a bit like not perhaps quite as good as Oxford Instruments, but it's in that sort of like research area that struggled, etc., over the last 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, the only recent news we've had from it was on the 13th of December, where it announced an acquisition for 9.3 million. The only problem is they're starting to get a little bit highly geared. Not high gearing, but it's sort of at the top end now of what I'd be comfortable with for debt. We think it's pretty good, actually. We're amber green on it. I think it sold off too much after some missteps under the previous CEO who was replaced, and it seems to be on the mend, doesn't it? I mean, the last results were H1 results, which we were to October, which we looked at on the 3rd of December. They looked all right. PBT up 22%, in line full year outlook. So yeah, it looks like it's settled down, and it's I would say it's actually quite good value now.
Yeah, no, I
is
would
it
agree. On
imaging software? Is it? Is that right? Something like that.
Yeah, I think it's basically hardware and software. They sell the
Is
hardware
it?
into labs and imaging and to, you know,
Right.
sort of like into manufacturers and this sort of stuff. But there's obviously a software layer to be able to convert the what you're seeing into sort of like and I think research and development, you know, having had a really tough time of it because of obviously increasing interest rates around the world have stopped people doing a lot of R&D. And then you've had the US in the labs basically nailing their NIH, you know, sort of like a healthcare R&D through the government. So it's been really tough. We've come through that, and you can just see actually it's turned up, you know, over the last sort of like year or so. I think this is an interesting one because it trades at, as you say, it trades at a reasonable sort of 7.5 times EBITDA for a business that's got lots of operating leverage. And if the market on research does start to actually increase for labs, then these should be a beneficiary of it.
Yeah, and I mean, it all with these buy and build or buy and improve or whatever, it all boils down to, doesn't it? Are the management any good at executing acquisitions? That's the only thing, really. And certainly the chairman I've spoken to here, Ken Ford, I mean, he's a very experienced guy, and I think they've got other Neds on the board in particular as well, who you know have done lots of deals over the years. So it was just a pity they had that big setback. Was the shares were, ooh, I think they hit about 2 quid, didn't they, at the peak, and then they dropped down to 50p. 50p, so they lost 3/4. However, the big tell, which I saw at the time, I was kicking myself for not buying any. The chairman waded in with six-figure pounds worth of share purchases, and that was putting up a huge flashing neon sign, wasn't it? Saying this thing's cheap, and sure enough, they doubled in a few months. The shares doubled, and they come back down a bit now. But I think it's in a it looks all right. I think SDI, yeah.
Good. All right, well, great place to finish. Thanks again, Paul. Hope you have a nice working holiday or a bit of a out in Malta. And
Just
thanks everyone.
working remotely. No, we don't use the holiday word.
Thanks everyone for your questions. Same time, same place, 2 o'clock next Wednesday. Thanks, guys.
Smashing. Thanks, Paul. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.